We're in Studio City, California, to visit with a man who contributed so much to the radio days that we hardly know where to begin. We're talking with Arch Obler, and where should we begin?
Let's begin back at the Merchandise Mart in Chicago, because that's where I began.
You actually began in radio writing at that point?
Yes, I wore out dozens of pairs of pants, the seats of them only, sitting in the reception room of NBC, hoping breathlessly that I could catch the eye or preferably the ear of one of the network executives with one of my plays. I ran out of breath just then because we've been talking about smog, haven't we?
Right, before we started.
Well, it's a long distance from the river taking its bend up there under the Michigan Avenue Bridge and going down past the Mart.
How did you sell that first radio play to NBC? Was it to NBC?
Well, I was fortunate in this sense that, well, fortunate nonsense. We all know that life is a series of fortuitous mishaps and good luck and misfortune. And this was good fortune because they were opening up Radio City in New York, which, of course, was to be part of the world of the future. Isn't it funny, about every 10 years we decide we need a new future world? And one of the executives at NBC remembered that one of the plays that I had been trying to interest him in was the one called Futuristics, a tongue-in-the-cheek look at the world of the future. So they bought it. And they bought it for the magnificent sum of $75. And I remember when they told me it was $75, I batted my big red eyes and I said, "But Mr. Menzer, I've worked 4 months on this play. Is that all I get, $75? And then I got one of those lectures on you should be happy that we are permitting you, you know.
But that was a big break for you to have a play produced on the air then, wasn't it?
It was, but it almost cut my career short because since it was a play about the future, I had a tongue-in-the-cheek something to say about cigarettes. And in my play, I was concerned with the last of everything. We were having an obituary for the last horse in the future, and this was an obituary for the last cigarette, as I recall. Now, it just so happened that no one bothered to listen attentively when we were rehearsing. And when that hit the air, and the boys in brass heard me ribbing their major sponsors, that almost was the end of me.
But it wasn't. It was the beginning. And did you start working regularly with writing scripts for NBC at that time, then, shortly after that, or...?
No, you know, Charles, nothing goes that easily. It was quite a bit of time later that a chap named Willis Cooper got ill. And he had started a program called Lights Out. It was kind of a revolutionary program because it was an opportunity to write radio drama for radio. You see, up to that time, radio was an imitation of the theater and motion pictures. Lux Radio Theater, the Screen Actors Guild, they really were three-act plays done in the manner that one would do a play but not look at it. In Lights Out, when it was offered to me, I saw an opportunity. Since I knew that none of the executives would be up that late at night, it went on the network at 11:30 at night. So I knew blame well, as Mr. Carson knows now, on television, as Tom Snyder knows, that they stay up that late, but they rarely look at their own network at the time. So I started to do Lights Out, and although it was a horror series, one out of three was a horror play, and the other two were idea plays. And I had fun because, you see, I started to do radio for the year. It wasn't an imitation of anything. I took a few words, a bit of music, a sound effect, and suddenly you were transported wherever I wanted to take you.
You really knew how to draw a word picture, didn't you?
Well, speaking of word pictures and transport, I never dreamed, dear Chuck, that when you'd come over, you would bring your beautiful wife. And I think that a word picture of her simply couldn't be done on radio. You'd have to have three dimensions.
Now I know how you have been so successful all the years that you have been so successful.
On the contrary, as my father would say, a man is not dead until the day he sees a lovely woman and doesn't remark on it.
Well, for her, I thank you. You started literally getting away with murder then, didn't you, when you were doing the Lights Out series?
That's well put. The first play that I did, again, almost took me off the air. You know, even now, particularly among executives, they don't understand the impact of radio over motion pictures and over television. I've had a touch of both, and I know. Because in radio, and it's so old I hesitate to say it, but you give of yourself. You're part of the communication right now as your listeners are turning their pink ears to this. They're working at it because in their mind's eye, they're seeing me, they're seeing you. When I talk of the merchandise mart, they see the merchandise mart. It isn't on a flat screen. In television, you don't give of yourself except at peaks of high drama, sporting events, actualities. But in plays, they touch you emotionally, but I challenge the listener to remember the play that moved him a week ago. It's almost impossible.
It's on television.
On television.
Play, yes.
But in radio, I've had listeners remind me of plays that they heard 40 years ago. I've had that experience again and again. I had one the other day. Someone said to me, "You know, when I was 10 years old, I heard a play of yours, and I've never forgotten it." And I said, "What, Black Beauty? King Arthur's Round Table, The Dread as a Child?" "No," he said. And he told me a story that I wrote that I completely forgotten. And it was done that long ago. And it stayed there in his neurons, so to speak, because he gave of himself when he listened to that.
Well, that was, of course, the magic of radio, because we, as a listener, could participate, because we had to build the sets and do all of that at the suggestion of you, the writer, and the actors, and
yes,
the sound and a little bit of music.
Yes, that's the wonder of it, and that's why I'm quite excited, Chuck, because I'm going to tell you something now that hasn't been released yet. Perhaps by the time this will be played, it will have been told in the press, but I doubt it. But I'm going to do some radio drama again.
Are you?
Yes.
How wonderful. What and when and how and where?
Well, it's supposed to start sometime in the winter. It's going to be a syndicated show. I met a man who has complete faith in radio as an art form.
Mm-hmm.
When I use that art form, I don't want any listener to shudder. I use the word art form in the same sense that a painting is a special art form. Or lovemaking can be a special art form. Those are rare in the human experience. I'm being facetious, but certainly I'm talking of the theater as an art form, sculpture as an art form.
Mm-hmm.
Now, television is an art form, as I said before, during sporting events. When that amazing young man, Bruce... what was the name of one that decathlon? That's fame on television for you.
At any rate,
the man who won the decathlon, that beautiful specimen of a human being, when he was running that final 1,500 meters, not because he needed it to win, but because he knew he had won in the position he was in, second place, and this was life bursting at its seams inside of him. He had to just go. That was a special moment in sports. But when you see my field in television, it's rarely special. That's why they do so many documentaries. They try to reach for that special thing. But mostly you think to yourself, the bionic man, yeah. He buttons up his bionic shirt, and then when the curtain drops, he goes home, and does he bionically bust his wife or beat her? He's an actor playing a part. But in radio, they were not actors playing parts. They were people. They were human beings. Let me just illustrate what I mean, Chuck, if you bear with me. That right here and now, I can create images in your listeners' mind by simply saying to them, you know, I've created on radio many monsters, but I want you, yes, you who are listening there, to think of the person you hate the most. See them in your own mind. Isn't he or she the greatest monster you ever saw or met? And what if I were to say to you that they're going to walk up behind you right now and grab the back of your neck? See, your back of your neck begins to crawl. It has to. But if this were television, you'd look and you'd see the monster made by the special effects department. Mm-hmm. And that would be that.
I would think that anything can be much more frightening if you can conjure it up yourself in your own mind than someone else would do it for you. And you have your own limits of fright when your imagination is working, don't you?
Of course. In planning this new series with Harry O'Connor, this is the chap I started to talk about who has all his faith in radio, I was talking about an opening, and I was saying that what I would like the listener to think about in the opening of this new show, which I don't know what it's going to be called, Arch Obler's Plays. No, I don't know.
You've done
I
that.
Like that.
You've done
no,
that.
And I've done it. I had a boomerang on me. One time I did a show with Joan Crawford, her very first radio show, and someone in New York liked it. In the New York News, and there was a headline on the radio page. It read, "Arch Obler plays with Joan Crawford," and my wife didn't quite appreciate that. Or whatever we call it, we were talking about how to, you know, to open the show with something, you know, familiar. And I was saying that it's far more frightening if one were to sit in a room and suddenly a chair that one has known all one's life begins to rock or suddenly begins to glide over the floor toward you. That'd be a far greater monster than anything Hitchcock ever showed, or Outer Limits or what have you. Or if you heard a noise outside and you turned and that old familiar bush outside the window, the branches were suddenly like long fingers scraping at the window toward you. I needn't go further.
Wow, you can hook us right away. We'll look forward to the new Arch Obler series. We want to talk about the old ones too, though. Lights Out went on from Chicago.
Yes, it went to Chicago, initially. And then when I went to the coast, we had out here. Then I brought Boris Karloff back to Chicago to do his first radio. He was a charming man, such a gentleman. After when one thinks of all the horrible things he was in, the leering monsters and that Frankenstein thing.
Well, he did an outstanding job for you, I think, on a Lights Out program on a story called Cat Wife.
Yes, yes. The man whose wife, because of the suggestion and because she has all the latent terrors in her of a witch cat, I started to say something else, thinks she's a cat, and now he tries to hide it from the world. I always have one marvelous picture of Karloff in Chicago. We finished a broadcast and he disappeared, and I knew how shy he was, and I suddenly realized that that he had left his cabin, was going down Michigan Avenue. And I went after him, and I had to run to get to him, and I said, "Boris, what is it?" And he said, "Look, look," pointing over his shoulder. Well, I expect to see Dracula and a few others and a few VP vice presidents of the network after him. It was about three little children running after him with autograph books. He was terrified. I solved the problem simply. You see, I intercepted the boys, and I said, "Let me sign." They said, "Who are you?" I said, "I'm Harpo Marx." And they accepted, and I signed Harpo Marx, and that took care of that.
But you don't look like Harpo Marx.
I do indeed. I, at Metro, when I was working there, I'd have more fun. One day I met Harpo, and I told him the story, and he said, "Isn't that funny? I always sign Arch Obler."
He spoke. When you were writing in Chicago, you were writing more than just the things for Lights Out. You wrote for the Little Theater off Times Square, didn't you? The First Nighter program?
Well, before Lights Out and trying to make a living, I was writing for that program. It was Don Ameche and Seymour. But that wasn't really radio drama. That, again, was an approximation, an imitation of. But what I was writing Lights Out for was in the hope that out of that, the network would let me do a series of plays on a more fortuitous time where I could write about the world, write about human beings and conflict or
in happiness. Did you get to do that?
Yes, but the only way it happened was this. I was in New York and getting nowhere, and I had just about had enough of Lights Out. So I got a group of actors together, and there were no greater group of radio actors than were in existence at that time. And up in my apartment, I got them in front of a microphone, and I rented a record maker. In those days, there was no tape. Mm-hmm. You had to scrape the grooves out in a big record. And I made a recording of a thing called The Ugliest Man in the World. And a few days later, I took that and brought it in to a marvelous man named Louis Titterton, a rare kind in the network. He was head of the literary part of the network, whatever that meant. And I brought my own record player, and I said, "Mr. Titterton, I know you're a very busy man, but please bear with me. Just hear the beginning of this." Well, this was such, as they say in France, chutzpah, to actually bring a record and a tape player and put it on one's desk. So I started to play it, and he listened to the whole thing. He didn't say a word when I was finished. I stopped the record player. He picked the record off and disappeared. And about an hour later, he came back, and he sat down behind his desk, and he looked at me, and he said, "I have just left the general." That meant General Sarno, head of NBC in those years. And he said, "You are going on the air at 8:30 on the Blue Network on a series to be called Arch Obler's Plays. Good luck." And that was
it. Wow, that went a long time, too.
Oh, yes, it ran a very long time. So suddenly the ogre turned into a fairy princess or with a long wand and a star at the end of it. And life was beautiful.
A few years ago, there was a series on radio, just a few years ago now, called The Devil and Mr. O. Now, were those shows newly produced, or were they reworkings?
No, those were old plays. What happened was that a couple of fellows who had been in charge of the Armed Forces Radio Services, and for those who don't know, the Armed Forces have their own radio network, wherever its troops are stationed, decided that perhaps the troops had never heard real radio. They asked me to contribute some of my plays. So I did on the old recordings. And the results were such, since these kids had never heard anything but the top 40, that the two young men resigned from the Armed Forces and decided to go in business. Well, they were about 5 or 6 years premature.
Mm-hmm.
The radio wasn't quite ready for that yet, and they did. They had just enough money to get started, but they didn't have enough money to go around to all the stations and to knock on doors,
mm-hmm.
and to do the sales job that one has to do even if one's selling a Ferrari.
Mm-hmm.
And in case anyone who's listening doesn't know what a Ferrari is. A Ferrari is a king-sized pizza made only in Italy.
You mentioned, part of the audience there, a little rough going. You mentioned that you worked for Metro. When was it that you worked for MGM?
Well, that was during the war when Avalon's mayor had heard some of my radio plays and wanted me to see if I could do the same kind of thing in motion pictures. That is, up to that time, they'd never had just an hour motion picture. And so I was supposed to make an experimental hour. And they picked on a play that I didn't like particularly, one of mine, but it was radio. It was not motion pictures. And I made it experimentally, and it was not supposed to be released, but of course they released it. Made a lot of money, but I was very unhappy.
What was it called? What was it?
I honestly don't remember the title of it. I know that a young actress named Phyllis Baxter was in it, and the man who married Ann Baxter and died very young. Again, I don't know that trivia, don't remember it. But it was an interesting play in that, well, I know Time said it was the first marriage of radio and motion pictures, whatever that means. But it wasn't happy, and it taught me my first Hollywood lesson. When they say to you whether you're a starlet or a writer or a director, they say to you, do this for me and the next one is for you. Don't you believe it?
Were you still very much involved in radio work at the time you started developing 3D for the motion pictures?
Oh no, radio was well behind me because a thing that I had invented called television had come along. Very few people know that in my other life I was known as Professor Zworkin. In any event, I didn't like flat motion pictures. I still don't. You know, one doesn't realize, unless one thinks about it, that the only time in life that one sees things not in three dimensions is when one goes to motion pictures. Even when you're looking at television, you're really seeing in 3D because your eyes are always cruising around, your peripheral vision, you see the room in 3D. But in motion pictures with that wide screen, you see it flat. And we become accustomed to it that way. The curious thing is that the inventors of motion picture, going back to France, going back to Thomas Edison here, they started out making 3D movies because they knew that since this is what we had in life, why should we have it in our entertainment? But it got in the hands of the people who wanted to make it as cheaply as possible, and they're still the same way. Sure, they spend millions and millions on stars, unquote. They'll make a shark that'll cost, you know, $1.5 million. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to exciting new technical developments in motion picture, they happen only because someone pressures them into it. As I did, for example, with my first motion 3D picture, Buona Devil. As a result of the tremendous excitement that picture engendered, CinemaScope came out, Cinerama came out a little prematurely. Of course, Cinerama doesn't exist anymore, and CinemaScope don't exist anymore. There are Cinerama theaters, but they're not showing Cinerama pictures. Because technically they ran into too many problems with their three cameras. And it was flat. You can curve a picture all you want. But unless you do what God has done over 4 billion years of evolution, give us one image for the left eye and a dissimilar image for the right eye, and both of them mixed in your optical brain center, you cannot get 3D.
No, you had everybody in the theaters wearing the glasses with the green. Was it the
no,
green
no,
and the
that was,
red?
No, that was long before that. That was an experiment. I had nothing to do with. No, we had polarized glasses to keep the left eye from seeing what the right eye sees, what the right eye sees, what the left eye sees. But nothing has changed since Bonded Devil, in that here I'm sitting on a 3D process that's absolutely perfect, and the response I get from all the executive friends and enemies in the industry is, we're making so much money with what we've got, we don't need anything new. And that's an exact quote of one of the presidents of one of the largest companies. Now, I ask you, what other industry has that, does that kind of nonsense? If the automobile industry tried that, the company would be out of business in 2 years. The only reason that the motion picture industry gets away with it is because they're making their monies out of oil wells, out of real estate, out of subsidiary things, out of television. That has nothing to do with motion pictures.
Did you have anything to do with the television series of Lights Out programs?
No, I refused to have anything to do with it because I felt strongly at that time that unless it's done by someone who has more than the usual kind of perception, you cannot start putting horror on the screen without having endless gore and violence. And my thesis was that if you break a bone and murder one person in one series or in one play, then the next time to get more effect you'll have to do twice as much. And that's exactly what's happening on television now with the escalating violence.
Now, when you were writing, when you were working in the radio days, you had almost total control over the entire program, didn't you?
Not
you
wrote, almost. I had complete
you
control.
You had the whole thing.
Yes.
You wrote, you produced, you directed, you cast the actors.
And I swept out the studio when I was finished.
And you even...
I served lunch. Oh, I had a thing going there.
Was it a good thing to have an Arch Obler lunch?
Well, the only problem with an Arch Obler lunch, it was always a bit late. It was always working on a deadline.
Did you always have your script intact at the time you went on the air?
I can hear numerous actors still in Chicago chuckling in their beards and up their pinafores now if I said yes, because many a time I would write it during rehearsal.
During the rehearsal?
Yes.
Did you... I understand that you didn't always get along well with your talent, your actors. As a matter of fact, one time you even took a punch at an actor, didn't you?
To put it very simply, I have respect for one thing only. That is not temperament, but talent. All the rest of it is just dressing. It's nonsense. I got along beautifully with actors and actresses. Unlike Mr. Hitchcock, I respect actors and actresses. I don't think, as he has been widely quoted as saying, that he thinks they're children and he wished he could do without them. I think they have a very difficult task, and they live a very difficult life. That bark, for your information, is a small, very small poodle named Happy, and he's truly happy. And he's always worried that someone's going to hurt me. What he could do with his 5 or 6 pounds, I don't know, and he thinks his microphone is an enemy. About actors, most people don't realize that the average life of an actor is 7 years. 7 earning years. So if they have trepidations and nerves and concerns. My only episodes with actors, and that particularly one that you talk about, was a man now deceased by the name of Lou Merrill, a very fine actor. But he had all sorts of inner hates and inner turmoils. And unfortunately, I think in this broadcast, we're doing one with, I think it was Greer Garson, and he was playing opposite her, and he was difficult. Oh, we had so little time, and through the microphone all through the rehearsal he was making all kinds of scurrilous remarks at his director. And just before we were in the air, he said something, and I don't remember anything except literally seeing red, and they tell me I tore out of the control room, tore into the studio, ran up to him, and with the hardest punch I've ever thrown, and I used to fight in the ring when I was young. I hit him smack on the jaw. Since he outweighed me about 3-1, he... That sound was not skeletons, but the mail being delivered, and Happy tearing up all the checks. Tear up the bills, Happy, not the checks. So Lou shuddered, and just at that moment I saw the red arm of the clock go up to tell me that we were on the air. The red light went on, and I pointed at him, and the reflex action worked. He began to talk, and he did a beautiful performance. And after that, we were very, very good friends. We never had any more trouble. But I don't recommend to budding directors that they break their hands as I did.
You broke your hand?
I broke a knuckle on the jaws of unfortunate actors who are feeling their oats at the moment. There are other ways, I assure you.
Did you mostly have, I know that the audience has loved Lights Out and so many of the other things that you did. How were you able to tell the audience reaction? Did you get feedback? Did you get mail feedback, telephone feedback? How was it?
One of my shows, the very first Lights Out, the one that I started to say a long time ago in this talk that I'm having with you, almost took me off the air, we got 50,000 letters. Mostly, there were no letters.
50,000 letters for one show?
Because I touched a raw nerve of many, many listeners. And I simply won't go into it other than to say that as a result of that, I learned the responsibility that the artist has in any medium. That he's got a tremendous load on his back. The people who do unfortunate things on television that result in some juvenile hoodlum copycatting and doing unfortunate things, and then the artist, the writer, or the director, or the producer. Well, it isn't like we didn't do that sort of thing on television, or it wasn't a result of us. Nonsense. We all have that responsibility. But mostly, as is true today in television, if a sponsor gets half a dozen letters, it shakes him. I mean, disliking something. Most people are not letter writers. But I knew it in my gut when I had done a good show. I could tell by the response of the actors. I could tell by the people in the control room. There'd be a dead silence the whole program. And then there'd be the expiration of air if it was a suspense thing. Oh, we knew. We all know when we do good, whether we're making horseshoes or whether we're delivering newspapers or writing them or what have you. We know.
You set the scene yourself for so many of the stories that you told on radio. You actually were on the air, and you would set the scene. Was that a style that you purposely decided to develop, or did it just happen?
Well, I'm no Orson. I did it because I wanted that one-to-one with the audience. You know, the audience that is listening to this is not a mass audience, as the advertising people always say. It's one-to-one. Mm-hmm. I'm talking to one ear, that ear that you're listening with out there. And that's why I introduced the plays. And I try to relate them because the most effective things on the air are those that touch our own lives. We're interested in ourselves, let's face it. And so when I wrote a play such as The Visitor from Hades, it was one of my favorites, about a young couple having a climactic quarrel. Their marriage had reached the point where inevitably that tremendous final quarrel had to be the one that stripped both of them naked. And when I introduced it, I didn't say, "We're going to scare the girdle off you, ma'am, and the panties off you, mister." I simply said, we all quarrel. I quarrel with my wife, mm-hmm. she quarrels with me. But I hope in our quarrels there are kind of a communication. And I'm going to tell you about a quarrel tonight that was a communication, but it was a terrible kind of meeting of minds. Just listen and see if it's one of yours or one of yours that's going to happen. As simple as that.
Your voice is spellbinding, and I think it's the quality of it that draws that one listener a little closer to the radio to hear everything that you have to say, and they don't want to miss a syllable.
Well, I always like to have one person in mind. You know, I, over the years, have known the great and the near great and the notorious and what have you, and the comedians. And the best of the comedians, for example, have told me that they always say in Vegas, pick out a face in the audience and play to mm-hmm. that face. Mm-hmm. I always have a picture of someone in mind, and I always am talking to her. I've never met her. I don't know what she looks like, but I'm always talking to her. And someday, good heavens, Chuck, she looks like your wife.
I think we better pack up and go. Arch Obler, do you consider yourself primarily a radio writer?
Well, the nice thing about maturing is that you begin to evaluate. I suppose I think of myself primarily as a human being, and secondly as a writer, but not a radio writer necessarily. I'm interested in all the media.
Do you feel that we might ever be lucky enough to have radio to even a small degree come back the way it was in the 30s and the 40s?
Well, that's what O'Connor and I are going to try to do. It's mm-hmm. going to be an interesting experiment. You see, listeners don't realize in radio, and television viewers don't realize, and moviegoers don't realize, that what they get in the medium they're interested in is not necessarily there by accident. It has to be purchased first. The cinema has to be purchased by the exhibitor before they get to see it. The television program has to be agreed to by the television executive of the particular station. And so what your listeners hear on radio is what the executive of that particular station wants. So it all boils down to, will the radio station managers want a radio drama? I don't know. As you know, CBS has had a program on for some time now, CBS Mystery Theater. There's been all sorts of rumors about its success or lack of success in commercial terms. I know the producer of it, and he's a hard-working, intelligent man. But with all due respect, that isn't the kind of radio that I want to do. That program, and that's the only one I can talk of, it's the only one on the air, does radio in a kind of a broad radio sense. Only rarely does it do it impressionistically, the stream of consciousness. I'm not talking about narration. I'm not talking about an actor mumbling. I'm talking about a character who is turning himself inside out for you, letting you know his innermost thoughts, not in a literary manner, but as we think in our own heads, something that only radio can do. Well, whether that kind of thing will go, I repeat, will be up to the station manager. And beyond that, one can't say.
Well, we wish you a lot of success with that. And you gave me a great cue line here about turning itself inside out. It's one of the great things you ever did was the story of The Dark with the
Charles, you know too much about my plays.
The bodies coming, you know, the just being turned inside out, and the great sound and the great setting.
It's terribly funny. I was in the Mike Douglas show a few months ago back in Philadelphia, and he wanted to do a radio play on his program, and I said, it's disaster. And that was the particular one they wanted to do, the turning inside out. And I tried to convince his staff that that is purely for radio, that the entire punch of it, the entire excitement of it, is you in your own mind seeing that man turning slowly inside out so that his vital organs are hanging outside and the blood vessels are pulsing outside and the raw flesh is outside. How can you do that on television? Because you can talk about it, but ha ha ha. Well, the staff persisted, and it was a shambles, I assure you. In fact, it was such a shambles that after about 3 minutes of it, right in front of the camera, I got up and stopped it. I said, we might as well stop because I've accomplished what I wanted to do. I finally turned Mike Douglas inside out, ha ha ha, and that was that.
The only way. They never learn, do they?
Yes, the media cannot be mixed. They can't be mixed. There can be intermixing of many things, but as anybody knows chemistry, there are certain chemical elements that just don't go together. You have an atomic fission or fusion in various scale, and that's what happens when you try to mix radio with any other media. For example, I've had 5-6 books of radio plays published. Read them out loud and on stage, and they're nothing. Sit quietly and read them in your own mind, and it's another story completely. They were written for the medium.
You have been a tremendous contributor to radio, and I cannot thank you enough, not only for having this chance to sit down and chat with you, but for everything you did. Every single thing you did for radio was head and shoulders above what most of the other people were doing, and for that we really want to thank you, Art Schober.
Well, I think you're being exceedingly kind. I can only thank you for bringing back memories of Michigan Boulevard in the wind, Merchandise Mart coming around the corner in the spring. The air was full of wonderful things in those days, even though I was hungry. And above all, I thank you, and I mean this sincerely, for in the midst of some very tedious work, bringing in not only those memories, but a very lovely lady.
Thank you very much, Art Schober.